is one of our Rosh Yeshiva here at Yeshiva University. Rav Miller lives in Yerushalayim in Eretz Yisrael. For the last 2 years, he has been one of our Mashgichei Ruchani. And we have an opportunity to hear him speak about Eretz Yisrael and Medinat Yisrael from the perspective of Soloveitchik. Please give your attention to Rav Miller.
I want to thank Rick very much for setting up the program. Kvod HaRabbanim, Kvod HaTalmidim. I was asked to speak about the Rav's approach to religious Zionism, to Medinat Yisrael. To understand the Rav's view, first one has to understand a little bit about who the Rav was. Who here is a senior in high school? Juniors? So I wasn't much older than you when I entered the Rav Shir. When I was a senior in MTA, at that time you were able to skip. So I skipped to Rav Lichtenstein Shir, it was a college Shir. Then when I was a freshman in college, I went to the Shir of Avraham Soloveitchik, Zecher Tzadik Livracha. When I was a sophomore in college, I asked to go to the Rav Shir. And I had protektsia. And so they allowed three of us into the Rav Shir. It was a smicha shir. It was a shir. You had to be in smicha. You had to be post-college. But Rabbi Willig, who's speaking next door, Rabbi Spitz, Shalom Spitz, and myself, we were three younger fellows, and they let us go into the shir. I may have been bright enough to understand the shir, but I certainly wasn't old enough to appreciate the shir. Let me just describe to you the Rav as I recall him when I walked into the shir. He was about the age that I'm at currently, grandfather. And outside of shir, he would be very, very warm. Had always a twinkle in his eye, was smiling. But when he came into shir, he became very, very intense. And the eyes burned. You felt a burning in the eyes. He was brilliant. He had a tremendous amount of Torah knowledge, but just brilliance, the ability to be machadesh, to come up with always new insights, and he had a tremendous drive to understand everything better than anyone had ever understood it, from a new perspective. Let's just start all over again. Let's build buildings. Let's build buildings in our minds. Let's build structures. And there was always movement. It was never just sitting. One felt a certain electricity in the shir. He would ask a question, and someone would give an answer, and he said, "No, wrong answer." So the fellow said, "But Rebbe, that's what you said yesterday." She said, "I didn't ask you what I said yesterday. I asked what you think. That's wrong. Let's try again. Let's try and understand it as best as we can." That was the way that he gave shir. It was what one came out of shir feeling, on one hand exhilarated, on the other hand exhausted. There was a tension because at that time he would call on people, and if you didn't know the answer, he would get very upset. Or if you didn't know the answer because you weren't prepared enough, he would get very, very upset. So it was just amazing. Aside from that, he also had a tremendous power of speech. He was an orator. He could speak for hours in Yiddish or in English, and people would sit there mesmerized. It's hard to explain. Even people, not necessarily Talmidei Chachamim, just a person would listen to him speak and close his eyes and feel he's like listening to a Maggid. In Europe, he had the stories, and he knew how to pull people in. And he was a charismatic individual who was the leader of modern Orthodoxy because he taught all of the rabbis. 90% of the rabbis who were in America, he was their Rebbe. And so across the street in Lamport Auditorium, it sold out because you have your parents and your grandparents, uncles, in other words, your rabbis, those were the individuals to whom the Rav influenced. So his view on anything is very, very important in terms of understanding where we are as American modern Orthodox religious Jews. Okay, with that introduction, let me get to Medinat Yisrael. Let's take the Rav out of the picture and see what we have on the canvas. The Ramban in Chumash points out that when Klal Yisrael were at Mamad of Kriyas Yamsuf, pre-Kriyas Yamsuf, they were divided into four kitot. They were divided into four groups. They were all in the same situation, but how do you react to that situation where you have the water in front of you, you have Pharaoh's armies coming behind you, you have mountains to the side, you have snakes, you have scorpions. What do you do? So there are those that says, let's stand and fight, and those that says, let's commit suicide and jump into the ocean. Those that said, let's run away. Those that says, let's just faint. How do you relate to a situation? So in terms of how to relate to the Zionist movement before the Rav, without the Rav, we had basically three opinions, three perspectives, three groups of Jews. I'll take it from right to left. I shouldn't say that. I'll take it from extreme to extreme. Okay. Without giving labels. So on one hand you have the Satna Rebbe. Al HaGula V'Al HaTemura. HaKadosh Baruch Hu sometimes sends us bait, B-A-I-T. A trap to see if we're going to fall for it, a nisayon. Like Adam HaRishon. HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, here, I'm putting you in Gan Eden. However, there is that Eitz Hadas, Torah, don't touch the fruit. The fruit looks very enticing. The fruit looks very, very delicious. It was there to see what Adam would do with that command. So here, according to the Satmar Rebbe, that's exactly our situation. HaKadosh Baruch Hu sent us into Galut. He sent us into exile because of our sins. Avodah Zarah, Gilui Arayos, Shfichus Damim, Sinas Chinam. And he wants us to correct ourselves. And he made us take three oaths when we went out into exile. And one of those oaths is Shelo Ya'alu B'choma. We're not going to, by force, push our way back into Eretz Yisrael. We're going to dive into Hashem, and we're going to wait. We're going to have patience. God said that there's going to be a kibbutz galuyot. God said that Mashiach is going to come. God said he's going to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash. We believe in God. We're going to wait. And so if there are those individuals who, from a non-Torah perspective, decide they want to set up a nationalist movement, that's a bait. That's simply a nisayon. It's a maisa satan. They want to see how strong our emunah is. And our emunah is that we took these oaths and we're going to stick by our oaths, even though being in Golot is very, very difficult. But we're not going to fall for the trap. We're not going to fall into that trap of the Maisa Satan. Either is a Medina currently, it's just a passing illusion. It's a rebellion against God. It's like eating from the Eitz Hadas, Tov V'Ra. It's the wrong way of behaving. That's one opinion. Second opinion is what we'll call the Aguda opinion, the Agudas Yisrael opinion, Agudas Harabanim opinion, is not that extreme, but also very, very opposed. Herzl's Zionism was a secular nationalism. There was a problem. Jews were being persecuted. There were pogroms in Kishinev. There was a famous trial that I'm sure you learned about a Jewish officer in the French army who was framed. He was a scapegoat for someone else's mistakes, and he was court-martialed, and he was sent off to an island, etc. And there was a feeling among Jews, something has to be done. We have to solve this problem of terrible anti-Semitism that the goyim can do with us whatever they want, and we're going to set up a state. Where we'll set it up, there'll be argue, maybe Uganda, maybe in the area of Palestine. We're going to set up a state. To a religious Jew, secular Zionism, that's godless. We're not speaking over here about being a Maisa Satan. We're simply dealing over here with the fact that this is not, this has nothing to do with HaKadosh Baruch Hu per se. There's a problem. So you have to solve a problem. But to solve a problem with Kochi Va'otzem Yadi, to solve a problem by the fact that I'm going to solve the problem, we're going to create a Jewish state, where is God in all of this? And without God, you're taking Jews away from Judaism. And taking Jews away from Judaism, that's not the right direction. That's not considered to be a Jewish value. What would be the difference practically between Satmar and Aguda? What do you do on Tuesday? What do you do on Yom HaAtzmaut? Do you tear Kriya? Because you're dealing over here with a terrible Maisa Satan, which is pulling the Jews in the wrong direction? Or do you just ignore it? Do you just say Tachanun? It's a regular day. It's the fifth day of year. We said Tachanun on the fourth day of year. We'll say Tachanun on the sixth day of year. So we'll say Tachanun also on Ha'iyar. Or this year it turns out to be Vav-Iyar in any case. But we'll just go around. It's not our baby. It's not our concern. We're concerned about Jews. So we'll daven for the Jews. This might be a good place to live. We'll live there as well. But the state itself, a secular national state, is not a Jewish value. And then, on the canvas, aside from Satmar and Aguda, you have Rav Kook. Rav Kook is just the opposite of the Satmar Rebbe. This isn't a Maisa Satan. This is a Maisa of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We're talking over here about an Aschalta de Geula. The world has a framework in which we're Be'ikvisa HaMashiach, we're moments away from Mashiach coming, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu is giving us an ability to build a nation in Eretz Yisrael. This is Reishis Tzmichas Geulaseinu, and we should push ourselves to join that movement. What about the three the Shvuot? What about the oath that we took? Well, it was a mutual deal between us and the Goyim. We agreed to stay in Golos and not to openly fight to get back to Eretz Yisrael, but they agreed to treat us properly. They don't treat us properly. We're talking over here about even before the Holocaust, you know, with Kal Vachomer, Benosha Kal Vachomer, after we have the Shoah, everything, all the cards are mixed, everything is fallen down. We're free to do what we want. And to build a Jewish state, a national Jewish state, is a Jewish ideal. HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants us to be a Torah nation, not just individuals who keep Torah, not just communities that keep Torah, but a Torah nation. With the king, with the government, with the Beis HaMikdash. HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants us to have a land and a language, like to be a nation, to be an Am Yisrael. And you can't have a nation without a land, and you can't have a nation without a government. And so all of this is part of the building process. Rav Kook referred to the secular Zionists as holy rebels. Nachon, they're rebelling against the Torah u'mitzvos. But they're holy because they want to bring in the side of the nation. So we'll join them, we'll combine our religion with their nationalism, and then 1 + 1 equals everything. Equals you get the jackpot. You move into Eretz Yisrael, into Medinat Yisrael, you're bringing Mashiach, you have every right to bring Mashiach, because Baruch Hu expects us to bring Mashiach, and this is a time not for Kriya, not to tear our garments, not just to ignore it, chas v'shalom, and say tachanun. This is a time for halal v'hoda. Finally, after all these years of exile, we have a reishis tzmichas gulateinu. We're on the right track. We're on the track back. And the fact that there are those individuals who are involved in this process who don't understand totally what they're doing, but they're doing the right thing. Having a nation, having an army, having a government, having a land, that's what should be. That's what HaKadosh Baruch Hu, this normal state of Israel, that's intrinsically important. Now let's move to the Rav. Once we have the canvas and we have these three opinions, so the Rav came to America in 1932. When he came to America in 1932, he joined the Aguda. That was the family party line. His grandfather, Reb Chaim Brisker, was one of the founding members of the Aguda in Europe. And this was his mindset, that Eretz Yisrael is Eretz Yisrael. Eretz Yisrael has tremendous kedusha. I'm going, said the Rav, to study the halachos of Eretz Yisrael. I'll give shiurim on zroim and trumos and maasros. There's tremendous amount of kedusha in Eretz Yisrael. I'll give shiurim on hilchos malachim. I'll give shiurim on hilchos beis habechira. But the medina, a concept of a medina, that is something which is currently, if it's being run by secular Jews, if it's being run by secular nationalism, that's not our cup of tea. That's not what we're holding. 14 years later, in 1944, the Rav became the chairman of the Mizrahi in America. But the Mizrahi in America, under the Rav, was not Rav Kook. So what was it? How do you, firstly, what happened? How do you move from Aguda to Mizrahi? How do you move from negative to positive? And secondly, what is positive if not Rav Kook? Where do you have any more room on the canvas for a third opinion? We have an opinion of anti, we have an opinion of pro, and we have an opinion of neutral, apathetic. It's not our thing. We'll just ignore. Where is the room for a fourth opinion between positive, negative, and neutral? Where do you have room for a fourth opinion? So the Rav expanded on his thesis, on his theory, in a very, very powerful speech that he gave here in Lamport Auditorium, where you daven sometimes in the morning, those fellows who learn here, study here in MTA, Yeshiva University High School for Boys in Manhattan. So, you know, that's that same auditorium where you text and you fall asleep and you do all sorts of things. The Rav used to give shiurim there. And Dafka, when I was in high school much later than 1956, but when he would give an open shiur, the high school would come as well. I still remember he gave a shiur called Confrontation. There was a question of Jewish and Catholic relations. They brought the whole high school down. It was the first time that I was able to see and to hear him speak. Mamish, I was your age at the time, even a year younger than you. I was a sophomore in high school. But this was in 1956. And this speech that he gave was published later on and printed, and it's called Kol Dodi Dofek. It's printed over here in a volume called Ish HaEmunah. In the back of it, they have the essay Kol Dodi Dofek. What is Kol Dodi Dofek? Those of you who Erev Shabbos say Shir HaShirim, so when you get to the fifth perek, you already know the story that we have a couple, we have a boy, we have a girl, who are very much in love, and the boy has been away for a long time. For a long time he's been away, and it's night, and then the girl is sleeping. She's sleeping on her bed. Ani yishena v'libi er. The girl is sleeping, sort of dreaming, and all of a sudden, kol dodi dofek. All of a sudden, as she's in bed, she hears a knock on the door. Kol dodi dofek. And she hears a voice. Pitchi li, open up. Achoti, rayasi, yonasi, samasi. All sorts of terms of love and endearment. Honey, dear, open up. Open up. I'm here. I'm back. I've come back. It's night. My hair is full of the mist of the night, of the dew of the morning. Come, please open up. Let me in. All I want to do is to reunite with you. What's her response? Yawn. Pashatati akutanti. I'm not dressed properly. I'm already in my nightgown. Echacha el bashena. I should get up now and begin to get dressed. Rachatzti et raglai. I already took a bath. I took a shower. Echacha tanfem. You want me to get my feet dirty by getting out of bed and putting them on the floor? Combination of laziness, combination of apathy. Go away. Come back tomorrow. Come back at a better time. Come back when I'm dressed. I remember once, when I was much younger and going out with a young lady, decided to surprise her. And not this is not the woman I married. And knock on her door when she didn't expect me. And she opened it and she hadn't put on her makeup and she had pimples, etc. And she screamed, ah! I slammed the door in my face. Any case, she never answered my phone calls again. But in other words, this is just not interested. Just not, you know, it's this is not for me at this point of time. And she goes back to sleep. And then she says, wow, what just happened? This boy I've been waiting for, he knocks on the door. And she quickly gets up, and she gets dressed, and she goes to the door. Kamti ani leftoach ledodi. There's no one there. She goes running out, searching. Anyone see him? Disappeared. Tragic ending. She missed the opportunity. That's what we have in the fifth parak of Shir HaShirim. The Rav, in this article, in this speech, called Kol Dodi Dofek, claimed that this is the process, the beginning of Kol Dodi Dofek, is what is happening now. What is happening with Kum HaMedina? That as a nation, God is knocking on our door. He's telling us, I've been away. I've been away. We've been separated. There's been an exile. It's night. It's dark night. This is after the Holocaust. 6 million Jews are no longer with us. It's night, but I'm coming back. I'm coming back. Open the door. Open your hearts. Come, let's reunite. Let's get back together again. That's how he understood the concept of Qum HaMedina. Where did he see these knocks? Did all of a sudden New York Times come up with a headline, there's a knocking on the door? Knocking on the door means that he felt, that Rav felt, that God was intervening in history. That HaKadosh Baruch Hu was telling us, he was giving us signs that he wants something from us. He's talking to us via six knocks, six miraculous events that accompanied Qum HaMedina. This is the knocking according to the Rav. This is what God is knocking on our door, wanting to see what our response is going to be. And so I'll just go through with you those six miraculous events, the six, you can read it inside of Kol Dofek. I'm sure it's been translated into English as well. The only copy I have over here is a Hebrew one. The first knock, said the Rav, was in the political realm. There was a vote in the UN as to whether to recognize the ability of the Jews to have a national homeland, to have a state. There was a vote. The UN at that time was divided into two huge blocks. There was the American bloc, and then there was the Russian bloc. The Americans and the Russians were in a Cold War. This is the late 1940s. The Americans and the Russians are locked in a Cold War. This is post-World War II. How do you redivide the world after destroying Hitler? So you had Stalin and his henchmen, and then you had the Americans. And the question was, where are the lines going to be drawn? Who's going now to be the most powerful nation in the world? These two blocks never voted the same in the UN. They were always, whatever the Americans were in favor of, the Russians were opposed to. The Russians were in favor, the Americans were opposed to. That's where they had their fights. That's the Cold War. They had their fights over the voting in the UN. When they called on the U.S. head of the mission to vote, he got instructions from Truman, vote in favor. After U.S. comes USSR. They called on the Russian. Everyone was already marking their page. No. He said, yes, I vote in favor. It's the only time in the history of the UN in that period that the Russians and the Americans ever voted on the same side of the table. It made no sense politically. It was the Arabs against the Jews. The Arabs had nations. Everyone wanted Arab oil, be they the Americans, be they the Russians. So America, you'll say, well, maybe they had a bit of a conscience after World War II that they had just left the Jews to be killed, and so maybe Truman had a conscience. But Russia, what did Russia care about the Jews? But they voted in favor. The Rav view said that maybe the whole UN only existed for that vote. The whole concept of the UN only came about to bring about that miracle. So you have one knock in terms of something that politically should never have happened. Al piderach hateva, no one would ever have predicted that this would have occurred. Second knock. Second knock was in the military battlefield. David against Goliath. You have a Haganah. They didn't have any airplanes. They hardly had any ammunition. They didn't have mortars. The soldiers, many of them were Holocaust survivors, off of the boat and right into a uniform, fighting against armies of Lebanon and Syria and Jordan and Egypt and Iraq and all surrounded, all entered into the battle, and David defeated Goliath. That's a nace. That should not have been according to any theory of military strategy. But there was a nace within a nace. The nace was that the Arabs began the war. They declared war. Had they not declared war, had the partition agreement that the Americans and the Russians had voted for, had that gone into force, we wouldn't have had Yerushalayim. We wouldn't have had half the Galil. We wouldn't have had most of the Negev. I don't know if you've ever seen what part of Israel we were given by the United Nations. It was a miracle that gave us anything. But it was not. It was only because of the war that we got half of Yerushalayim, the Galil, the Negev. It was only because they began the war. It's like as though Paro had decided not to chase after Klal Yisrael. So after 3 days, we would have returned. But because he chased, okay, all deals are off. So now there can be a Kriyas Yamsuf, etc. So over here, because they decided to declare war, we got a Medina that included a Galil, a north, a south, an east, a west. We received such a gift. That's a knock from a Kadosh Baruch Hu. A, that there's a war. B, that we defeated the Arab armies. Third knock. The third knock is in a realm that was very, very dear to the Rav's heart, and that's theology. The Rav was a doctor of philosophy. And in terms of theology, the Rav was astounded. He viewed this as almost the most fascinating, important, miraculous event. Christianity is the major religion in the world. The Christians view themselves as being the New Testament. The Jews had the Old Testament. Namely, there used to be a connection between the Jews and God. But then when Jews rejected the Messiah, when Jews rejected Jesus, so we were sent into exile as punishment. The wandering Jew. All of the Nevuot, all of the prophecies of Zion and Jerusalem, that moved over to the Christians. They set up the churches in Zion and Jerusalem. And we are the wandering Jews for eternity. This is our punishment, to be persecuted here and persecuted there because we rejected. If we'll accept the Messiah, wonderful. They're willing to missionize us. But as long as we reject, we have no divine rights. God hates us. God looks down upon us. We rejected that which he wanted to give us, and they took it. They have the new covenant, and we're in exile. All of a sudden, their whole theology, the rug was pulled out from underneath it. All of a sudden, the Jews are back in Jerusalem. The Christians didn't know how to deal with this. It's against the whole tenet of their theology. They're wrong. We're not the wandering Jew. We came back to Zion. So they tried... Zion doesn't mean New Jerusalem. Zion means Old Jerusalem, the Yir HaAtikah. That we didn't have in 48. But then, this wasn't part of the Rav's speech, then came 67. So then they had to try and say, well, let's internationalize Jerusalem. Namely, that this is for a believing Christian, our coming back to Eretz Yisrael just undermines his entire faith. That's a miracle. That's something that should be changing the entire world, were they to be aware of it, or let their people be aware of it. That's the third knock. So we have the political knock, we have the military knock, we have the theological knock, and then we have the fourth knock, which is the fact that you're sitting here today. What does that mean? That Jews were assimilating en masse, particularly in America. They were losing any sense of pride in being a Jew, any sense of identification as a Jew. They moved from Orthodox to conservative, conservative to reform, reform to secular. And what did that mean? It means that you were an American. You were an American who happened to, once upon a time, have been connected with the Jewish people. But what was Jewish people? There was no Jewish people. It was just a religion. All of a sudden, you have a state. People who were not religious became proud Jews. They had something to live for. They're going to support the state of Israel. They're going to collect money for Israel. They're going to send their children to Israel. It's their state. The state of Israel represents them. It stemmed the tide of assimilation that was going on and gave a chance for these people perhaps to become more religious, but simply they remained as Jews. They married Jews. I believe in Israel. You believe in Israel. Let's get married. Not because they were Jewish religiously, but all of a sudden they had something that they were that gave them a reason to have a Jewish identity. As a parenthetical comment, what the Six-Day War did to the Jews in Russia, that's what the War of Independence did to the Jews in America some 20 years earlier. It gave them a sense that they're Jewish and enabled our people, as a Jewish people, to be strong, to have influence in America, APAC, and all of the all of the various influences on Congress, etc., etc. That was the fourth knock. The fifth knock, according to the Rav, the fifth area in which we see Yad Hashem is the change of the attitude of the world to the Jews. Jewish blood is no longer hefker. There's someone who will fight for the Jews. The Jews can defend themselves. For the first time since Churban Bayis Sheni, for the first time in close to 2,000 years, the Jews have an army. They have a secret service. They have an air force. If a Jew is killed anywhere in the world, there can be a concept of ayin tachas ayin, an eye for an eye. Whoever kills that Jew knows that he's going to be chased. Whether it's an Adolf Eichmann who's going to be chased in South America, whether it's those murderous individuals who killed the Olympic team of Israel in Munich, every one of them was killed. That Jewish blood is no longer just be spilled with impunity. That didn't exist. You read all of Jewish history. It's not just a question of the Inquisition and the Crusades, like these periods. Throughout Jewish history, a Jew was defenseless. It was totally up to the goodwill of his neighbors that he existed. When they needed a scapegoat, they would kill him. All of a sudden, they have to think twice. That's a change. That's a tremendous change in attitude. And the final knock, the final area where we see the hand of God, Yad Hashem, is in Kibbutz Goliot. Come to Israel. Just come to Israel. Get off the plane. Look around you. What do you see? You see Jews who came from Europe, Jews who came from Arab countries, Jews who came from Russia, Jews who came from Yemen, Jews who come from Ethiopia. The B'nai Menashe are coming from India. This is a fulfillment of prophecy. This is what was spoken of by Yeshayahu. This is what's spoken of by Yechezkel. This is what's spoken of by Yoel and by Tzfanya and by Zechariah. This hadn't been for 2,000 years. You had communities, but they were all separate from one another with their own minhagim. And now all of a sudden, they all come together. That's Yad Hashem. That's something which is fascinating. This is the religious Zionism of the Rav, that we have these knocks. We have Kol Dodi Dofek, our lover, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, who is knocking on our door and giving us an opportunity. And because of that, the Rav moved from the Aguda to this concept. This is a different area on the map. Just to stress the uniqueness of this, so there's a letter that the Rav wrote in 1957. And he wrote, "I agree with you that there's a third approach which is neither parallel to the position of those whose eyes are shut and reject the significance of the state, that would be the Aguda, nor the belief of those dreamers, like Rav Kook, who adopt a completely positive stance to the point that they identify the state with the fulfillment of the highest goal of our historical and meta-historical destiny. Reishis tzmichat geulatenu, atchalta de geula. The third approach would be positively inclined toward the state, would express gratitude for its establishment out of a sense of love and devotion, but would not attach to it excessive value to the point of its glorification and deification." Namely, it's not the end. It's a possible beginning. It's an opportunity. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is putting it in our hands as to what is going to be. And a very important opportunity, but no more than that opportunity. And Nachgemina, of course, is, well, what do you do on Yom HaAtzmaut? So according to the Rav, this is not a day for business as usual. This is not a day for saying Tachanun. You can't be indifferent. God is knocking. Certainly not a day for Kriya. On the other hand, it's not so clear that it's a day for Hallel with a Bracha, etc. We're not there yet. This is not Purim. This is not Hanukkah. There hasn't been that sense of we're over the hump. Our exile is over. Everything is now going to be hunky dory. Everything is going to be fine, and therefore, there are all sorts of opinions as to what the Rav himself did do or didn't do. When I was here in the yeshiva, there were many minyanim around the yeshiva, and the Rav had an apartment in Morgenstern dorm on the ground floor. and there's like a little shul next to it, which currently is a Sfardi Beit Midrash of Eidot HaMizrach. But then it was just like a lounge. And the Bnei Akiva decided to use that as their where they were going to daven on Yom HaAtzma'ut, and they were davening challah with a bracha, and the Rav just walked out of his apartment, and it was the closest minyan. So he went in, and he stood up front, and all of a sudden they begin, you know, a bracha on Hallel. All that's known is that the Rav put a talus over his head, and no one knows what he said or what he didn't say. Because it's, you know, this is an area which is unclear. Thanking God doesn't necessarily mean saying Hallel with a bracha. But there's another difference as well, and with this I'll conclude. And I want to share with you a story that I've never shared in public. But it's time to share. So I'll share it with you. As was mentioned by Rick earlier, I live in where's Rick? Okay, go on. Okay, as mentioned by Rick earlier, I live in Eretz Yisrael. I moved to Eretz Yisrael, Kanai Nahara, over 40 years ago. And About 30 years ago, my wife was accepted to Harvard for a year for a degree in education. And so the family at that time, we had, Baruch Hashem, three children. We moved to Boston for a year. My wife is Israeli. She was brought up on Kol Dodi Dofek. She went to Chorev. She went to a good modern Orthodox school in Yerushalayim. And this was part of the curriculum. This was part of the reading material. And so she wanted to meet the Rav. She wanted to meet the author of Kol Dodi Dofek. At that time, the Rav was slowing down. He was still traveling to New York, but he was not that firebrand that I had remembered in terms of Shir. And so I called him and asked whether my wife and I could come over and talk to him. And he was very, very gracious. And so I introduced my wife to him, and she said, "I have a question for you." I was very shocked. She didn't tell me she was going to ask the question. "I have a question for you." And she said as follows, I was brought up on Kol Dodi Dofek. And we in Eretz Yisrael have heard that there's a tradition, a brisker tradition, a tradition of your family, that in Jewish history there are only going to be two korbanot, two exiles, two destructions. That the current state of Eretz Yisrael, the current state of Medinat Yisrael, is not going to be a third korban. When Mashiach will come, who knows? But that we're going to stay in Eretz Yisrael, that this is a permanent part now of Jewish history. At some point, and this is going to morph into something which will bring about Mashiach. Is it true? Is this a tradition that you have? Do you believe in this? You wrote called it a fake. Do you believe that this is the direction that we're on? It may take a long time. There may be ups and downs, but the Medina is here to remain. Now, had you asked that question to Rav Kook, he would have said, "That's a no-brainer. Of course, it's Reishis Tzmichas Gulatenu." Had you asked that question to Satmar Rebbe, also it's a no-brainer. This is a Maisa Satan. This is a passing illusion. What about according to the Rav? He sat there, and he looked at us, and he said, "I don't know. I really don't know." That's his shita. Opportunities don't mean necessarily that there is going to be a living happily ever after. However, it's really up to us. An opportunity means a knock. Not one knock, not two knocks, not three knocks, not four knocks, not five knocks. Six times HaKadosh Baruch Hu knocks. How do we respond? HaKadosh Baruch Hu is still looking at us. Are we staying in bed? Are we getting up? What are we doing to link in with Him? What are we doing when He says, "I want to reunite with you"? Do we want to reunite with Him? Do we want to take Him seriously? Do we want to come back to Eretz Yisrael? Do we want to build, etc.? That HaKadosh Baruch Hu was waiting for. And how can one know what our response is going to be? The Rav was smart enough to know that he's not a prophet. The Rav was smart enough to know that the Jewish people is a very, very special people, but the Jewish people don't have the greatest track record in terms of saying yes when they should say yes and doing that which they should do when they should do it. Naaseh v'nishma was a very, very important moment in Jewish history. The question is, now, how does one respond to this knocking? And with that, I'll leave you to think on Yom HaAtzmaut. You should have a wonderful day, and Baruch HaAtzmaut.
Okay, guys, we are now going to the